Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, I'm Pac Romaine, and you're listening to SupDoc. On today's episode, we take a little departure from our usual format, where George and I talk to interesting people about their favorite hand-picked documentaries. Today, I am a solo host, and the film is Barry, about President Obama's early college years, which is more biopic than documentary. However, we couldn't pass up the chance to speak with the screenwriter of Barry, Adam Mansbach. Barry is currently playing on Netflix. I caught up with Adam at his home in Berkeley, California. For those people listening, we are recording this a week before our inauguration of the president-elect. Not my president, as I have been saying, but it is true, which makes this prescient that we're talking to the writer of the screenplay Barry, which is currently on Netflix. You can check it out. And what was what was the catalyst for you to write this? What was the reason? What brought this to you?
The initial germ of the idea was Vikram Gandhi, the director's. He came to me with the idea that we should do something about Obama at Columbia when he transferred there in 1981. Vikram and I both went to Columbia.
I see.
So I know him from college. And I think he read the pages and dreams from my father where Barry, as he was known then,
Barry
talks about Columbia. And I think he felt a sense of recognition that you know, when we got there 14 years later, it was much the same place. It was alienating. It was not as enlightened. It was not the bastion that we hoped it would be. And, you know, it's also a time in Obama's life when he was young and he was searching for meaning and identity. And it seemed like an opportunity. Oh, and also there's not that much on the record about it, right? It's not an incredibly well-documented time in his life. It's still relatively opaque. There were still liberties we could take, things we could invent without fear of contradicting what was on the record, because the record was limited.
Right.
You know, there was the pages and dreams, which there's like six of them that apply to this time period. There's a few interviews with ex-girlfriends, people who knew him. But it was a relatively sparse framework upon which I could improvise a story. So it was attractive to me in that way. And it was attractive because it seemed like a way to tell a fairly quiet story about race and identity and coming of age. But because this guy goes on to be the president, we could kind of get it into a mainstream conversation. We could, you know, platform it in a significant way. So to me, it was a really interesting challenge to try to retrofit who Obama was then based on what we know of him now. And he's still a bit slippery now. You know, there's a way in which the control that he has over himself, some people call it cool, some people call it aloofness, some people call it a professorial vibe, whatever it is, you know, I think there's still like a desire on the part of the American public, particularly the segment, the half of the American public that likes him, to know him better. And, you know, he's done his job with such elegance and calm that we don't see any cracks in the facade. We don't know him as well as we might want to. So on that level too, it was interesting to like try to figure out who he was and write it into existence.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, shown extremely well in Barry, is that kind of the quiet reticent. I don't know if that's the right word, but like he very thoughtful, Barry Obama, where I feel like he's at the crossroads. You know, and you guys did you and the director Vikram Gandhi did a great job of presenting that, because he's at this crossroads where he seems kind of a fish out of water. Would you think that's correct?
I think he's a guy who, at that time in his life hasn't figured out yet that the multitudes he contains are an advantage. They still strike him as a disadvantage. There's an exchange he has with a roommate where...
Will,
yeah, played by Elder Coltrane.
Yeah.
From Boyhood, yeah. He's a star of Boyhood. Great dude. Sweetheart. Oh, really awesome. Really cool guy.
Yeah.
Everybody on this movie, like, I really enjoyed hanging out with all these actors. I got to be on the set a bunch.
Oh, awesome.
And Will says, you know, Barry is complaining about how he's the only black dude in four of his five classes.
Right.
And Will is like, yeah, but you're half white too. And Barry looks at him like, what is that supposed to mean?
Right.
He's like, well, it means you can fit in anywhere.
Right.
And Barry looks at him like he's an idiot and is like, I fit in nowhere, Will. And that, I think, is authentic to how he felt at the time.
Yeah.
That being Kenyan and Kansan and Hawaiian and Indonesian and all of these things that he was were not adding up to more than the sum of their parts. They were somehow adding up to less.
Right.
And he's very much a guy seeking a scene, seeking an identity, seeking a place to feel like he fits in. But also at the same time, he's removed from it all. He's already entered kind of a monkish phase of his life. His days of partying are actually behind him at, right. you know, 21. Like, you know,
which is incredible.
Yeah, like he's on the downslope of that. He's not really drinking or smoking that much. He hasn't done coke in a couple years. You know, like he's not, he's already kind of like beyond that point. He's already kind of withdrawn into himself in a way, which, yeah, is a difficult thing to convey. There is a lot of silence to him in the movie. There's a core that is very quiet to him.
Yeah, absolutely. And your star, Devin,
yeah,
did an incredible job of finding those quiet moments and playing those quiet moments. And
yeah.
Did you ever find yourself in a crossroads of that where your like identity, cultural identity, your personal identity you just weren't sure of?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about a minute earlier about hip-hop and race and what it meant to be a white kid in hip-hop, particularly at a time when the dominant discussion was essentially about the historical evils, you know, perpetrated by the white race. You know, there was definitely a sense of like, okay, my favorite rapper in the world is like Grand Pooba from Brand Nubian, and all he wants to talk about is dropping the bomb on the devil white man.
Right,
you know,
right.
He's coming straight out of, you know, a kind of Elijah Muhammad inspired
cracker ass cracker
13, you know, Clarence 13X Nation of Islam, you know, Nation of Gods and Earths kind of sensibility. And you're like, okay, how do I both validate that I, you know, the truth of this, but not feel like I'm walking around, you know,
appropriating.
No, what's the space that I can carve out for myself to live in? I mean, yeah, those things certainly preoccupied me, you know, figuring out the difference between the personal and the political. Like, okay, how come I have all these friends who are 5%ers and they're supposed to think that I'm the white devil, but I'm like sleeping on C. Justice's couch three nights a week,
right.
You know, and I'm like me and this dude Divine Jihad are like, you know, robbing paint stores together, you know, like how do you figure all these things out? So yeah, there was a sense. I think identity is always in flux. It's always dynamic, and I've had a number of moments where I was trying to figure it all out around race stuff back then. You know, how do you exist as kind of some pro-black white racial activist? You know, what does that mean?
In
what
Boston.
Does that look like in Boston?
Yeah.
And then around the fact that also I'm Jewish, right? Which
yeah.
is a complex identity in itself. And I didn't grow up religious.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't bar mitzvahed even.
Right.
Nobody in my family really gave a shit about the religious aspects, yet everybody felt very like culturally Jewish. So like, what does that mean?
You didn't go to temple. It wasn't any of that stuff.
No, none of that stuff. No. I briefly went to a religious like a Sunday school that I got kicked out of.
For doing what?
I had this really racist teacher, as a matter of fact.
What?
This old dude named Israel Kagan, who was like 45,000 years old, grew up with fucking Methuselah, you know?
Yeah.
And he would literally talk about the Jews having to move out of Roxbury when the blacks moved in the 50s and say shit like, the reason the Jews are a great people is because they always give back to their communities, and the reason that the blacks aren't is that they don't, except for Satch Sanders from the old Boston Celtics.
Oh.
And I'm like, my man, what the fuck are you talking about? You know, I was already a hip-hop kid. I was, like, challenging him. I was like, that's bullshit. He was like, prove it. You know, I didn't really have the ammunition at my fingertips, but... And I was at an age where, like, you've been taught all your life that your teachers are right and they're to be respected. But here's this guy spewing what is clearly wrong to me. And I remember just struggling with it and acting out. And I just like, you know, just becoming disruptive and eventually getting kicked out after singing Living on a Prayer into a microphone at an all-school assembly when I was supposed to read like some Hanukkah prayer that was spelled out in phonetic Hebrew because I didn't even take Hebrew. Because this was the type of Jewish school where you didn't even have to take Hebrew.
Whoa.
So, you know, that's shit like lax. That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But yeah, grappling with the particulars and the vagaries of a Jewish identity later, particularly when I wrote a novel called The End of the Jews, you know, it's like, what does it mean to be Jewish? And when does that identity become weaponized? When do you use it? When do you not use it? Looking at my own family and how being Jewish might have played into my grandfather's life. Again, not a religious dude in any way, but like inescapable mm-hmm. for him as a lawyer, law professor, judge. You know, this dude was at Nuremberg, and then this guy was on the faculty of the Harvard Law School, and then he was on the state Supreme Court of Massachusetts.
Your grandpa?
My grandfather.
Holy shit. What's his name?
Benjamin Kaplan.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he was the first Jew to do some of those things.
Wow.
He integrated a tennis club in Cambridge, like he was the first Jewish member, and he didn't play tennis. He didn't give a shit. And he might not even have known that he was the first Jew, because this guy who was his mentor, who was this blue blood Boston Brahmin guy who was very invested in breaking down these boundaries, he would do shit like go and behind the scenes arrange everything so that when my grandfather applied, his application would be accepted.
Wow.
So there's all of these weird things. And, you know, a Jewish identity is, I think, a particularly weird one because there are all these ways to feel marginal and alienated from it, but you don't walk away. Right. You know, like you have Jews who say shit like, I'm Jewish, but I'm Buddhist. You don't really have Episcopalians who say shit like that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You can be Jewish and not believe in God. You can be Jewish and not go to temple, but you're still Jewish.
Yes.
What does it mean?
It's much more than a religious identification.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be Jewish.
Yeah. So, yeah, identity in all these realms is something I think a lot about.
And you drew from that when you were writing Barry?
Yeah. I did. Although, you know, I also wanted to be careful, and this was something that Vikram and I talked about a lot as we developed the story, wanted to be careful that I wasn't just substituting my experiences for Barry's or substituting Vikram's experiences as an Indian American guy at Columbia for Barry's. You know, it was like, there are things we relate to, there are reasons that we want to do this project based on our own empathetic connection to the material, mm-hmm. but it's also got to be particular and authentic to what he would have experienced, not just, you know, me with a different name walking around the streets of Harlem, you know, buying books from book vendors or whatever.
Right. And Vikram, I mean, it seems it could be kind of he made a great documentary, mm-hmm. which is kind of like the same kind of idea, which is a cultural identity and where does someone fit in? And I the name's escaping me now.
It's called Kumari.
Yeah, Kumari. Yeah, that's a great documentary.
Yeah, and yeah, very well done. Very funny.
Very well done. And it's about like, how do we associate people in our lives? Where do they fit? And what do we need in order to fit in into the greater world? You know, because people, basically he's, I don't want to say cons people, but he pretends to be a guru.
Yeah.
And people follow him. And then he's at the end is like, surprise.
Yeah.
You know.
But I think what's brilliant about that movie, which begins with Vikram musing kind of on the fascination with the East and with India and with yoga and gurus, and he decides to explore this by moving to Arizona, growing out his hair and his beard, and using his grandmother's accent and being like, I am the guru Kumari.
Yeah.
And immediately all these people in Arizona, all these white folks are like, oh, the aura, he's amazing. Yeah. I feel such energy from him. But what I think separates that movie from being just a prank or a con is that Vikram is not an asshole. Vikram is a really sensitive dude. And what he comes to realize in the course of the movie is that he somehow ends up feeling more honest and authentic as Kumari than he does as like Vikram from New Jersey.
Right.
You know, it's like he's having these interactions that are meaningful to him, even though they're under the guise of this fake invented persona. So not only does he have to reveal himself, but he has to figure out like, what has all this meant, you know, and who is he really in some sense? Yeah, I think it's a really powerful movie.
And at the end, there are people that still love him just as much, and he he forges some like friendships and bonds that
yeah.
It's kind of like, well, it doesn't really fucking matter.
Yeah.
What your name is, who you are, where you come from. Are you a good spirit? Are you friendly? Are you nice? Do you have good intentions?
Yeah.
You know, and like, I feel like in Barry, the same kind of themes were being presented. I mean, Invisible obviously was a through line because mm-hmm. you use the book, the Ralph Ellison book, and the name pops up a lot, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Barry, that's one of the things that was on the record. According to him, in Dreams from My Father, he carried around this kind of tattered copy of Invisible Man throughout his first semester. And it's a brilliant book. And the fact that Ralph Ellison at the time was living in Harlem is also kind of interesting. It fills in something about what New York felt like at that time. You know, an Invisible Man came out in 1953, and Ellison struggled for decades to write another novel and went through a bunch of shit and lost a draft in a fire. And, you know, at that time in 81, he was sort of holed up in his house in Harlem, and everybody was kind of like, what happened to him a little bit? But yeah, he carries that book around. He brings it to the basketball court. By virtue of that, another basketball player that he becomes friends with named PJ, played by Jason Mitchell.
From
Straight Outta Compton.
Awesome.
Yeah. He starts calling Barry Invisible as a nickname, and it becomes kind of a thing. And yeah, the tension between being visible and invisible and what that means in all its iterations comes into play throughout the movie. Barry feels both incredibly visible and incredibly invisible. And those two things are kind of in tension with each other.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, there is that duality there where he's the eyes are on him for, A, walking around with a white girl, you know, and trying to toe that line between where does he fit in the black world and the white world.
Yeah.
Which is a crazy duality to have. Like, that is something that you don't see very often. It's not like the story that's told very often is like mixed race people. Where do they fit in, you know? Because it's generally either like a black guy trying to fit in the white world. Rarely you see the other of that, where like white people trying to fit in the black world. But yeah, I think that it's very interesting too. It's because it's like, As we all know, is that Barry, does he choose the black world? Is that accurate to say?
I think you could make certainly an argument that he does, yeah. But I think really, more fundamentally, he also chooses to embrace the fullness of his heritage and his experience. And to let that kind of be a, you know, and he'll go on to kind of craft that into a metaphor for America.
Right.
There's a way in which, Greg Tate, who's one of my favorite critics, wrote a great essay on Baraka, which comes to mind because we were talking about Baraka earlier. And he says in it that Baraka's great strength and also the most frustrating thing about him has always been the way he consistently confuses his head with the Godhead, you know? The ways in which he kind of assumes that his struggle and his foibles and his issues like stand in for everybody's.
Right.
And I guess to some extent all writers have to do that, but you know, Obama has found a way to flip that around in a sense and find something universal in his own story and use himself as a metaphor for America in a way, which you sort of see him grappling toward in the movie a little bit. You know, we wanted it to be very kind of epiphany free. You know, we didn't want to like, we wanted to leave him in process and like on the precipice. You know, it's definitely not like the 6 months that made him the man he would become. You're like, no.
Right.
It's like six interesting months and a lot of shit happens.
Yeah.
But he's still trying to figure it out at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think certainly he moves toward embracing a legacy of struggle, of you know, responses to oppression, and he find, you know, there's a legacy there that he would be a different person if he didn't embrace and want to add on to.
I read somewhere that college isn't about learning; it's about training.
Training for what?
To want what you don't need, and to leave who you are at the door.
But we're supposed to leave who we are at the door. I mean, that's the point.
Well, some people can't leave who they are at the door. I mean, right, you know I'm the only black person in four of my five classes.
But you're half white, too.
What's that supposed to mean?
Just that you can fit in anywhere.
right? I fit in nowhere, Will.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Your film starts out in 1981 when he transfers to Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of see him like with his best friend, who I wrote down.
What, Salim.
Salim. Yeah. Now, is that based on a real friend or is that?
Yeah, Salim is based on somebody. It's a funny thing because it's like there are these layers you have to peel back because in his book, Obama kind of composites people. Mm. And so it's like, when you're compositing a composite, you know, right. You get these kind of compounded layers. But yeah, Salim, who in the book is Sadiq and in real life has a different name. There is a real guy at the heart of all that, a Pakistani guy who he knew when he got to New York through friends at Occidental. He had a number of Pakistani friends at Occidental, and he's the only guy that Barry knows when he gets to New York.
Oh, got it. Interesting. And like, I mean, Salim, you know, he's the like, the comic relief,
yeah,
you know, cat in this. Like one of my favorite moments, I mean, it's a really powerful moment, but one of my favorite moments is when Barack finds out his father has been killed and Salim is like, fuck it, I'm going to go to Wall Street, you know, and he's like, I'm going to get a job and like, and the Barry Barack is not saying anything because he's like, what the fuck just happened? And you have that split.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful. It's a really great scene.
Thanks. Yeah, I was on set when we shot that. Avi Nash, who plays Salim, was, in my mind, just incredible. Great dude. Stayed in character the entire time. Like, to this day, I still don't know what Avi actually sounds
Offset?
Like.
Offset?
Yeah.
Like, he slips into like four different voices. He does Barack.
He does a great Barack imitation.
He does
a great
white,
Barry imitation.
Yeah, he does a white person voice.
Yep.
He even has a slight British accent.
Yeah.
Is he British?
Well, he's Pakistani, but I mean he speaks English with a British accent as he would have being of that origin, you know, because of like when you learn English, you learn British English and
right,
a lot of the former
right.
Empire.
Like India and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, no, I love the Salim character. He was a joy to write.
He likes his weed.
Yeah. If anything, we had to prune him back because he threatened to take over the movie. Like,
yeah, at a certain point, you could see it. You could feel that.
Yeah, at a certain point, Vikram was like, yo, like, Salim is almost on screen more than Charlotte, and that we can't really have that. Like, we got to cut it back a little bit.
Right.
There were like, other Salim scenes that I wrote in the middle of the filming because the dynamic between Salim and Barry was so good that like partly we just wanted more of it and then like cooler heads prevailed and it was like wait like
yeah.
You know like
yeah it could turn into a comedy a duo a buddy comedy pick
oh yeah
with, like
we joked a lot on set about this spinoff that was just the further adventures of Salim.
Yeah. It could be called Go the Fuck to School or Go the Fuck to Class or something.
Yeah, and Avi's definitely somebody like Devin Terrell, like damn near everybody in the movie that I really look forward to hopefully working with again. But also Salim, besides being very funny, is also the guy who has no problem cutting Barry down to size.
Right,
talking
right.
a bunch of shit to him,
right.
kind of puncturing the bubble of his own self-regard. And, you know, whenever he gets grandiose, you can rely on Salim to, like, you know, shut him down. And they share an otherness in a way. You know,
right.
they're both outsiders. They're both other. They're both brown kids. But they also have very different paths and goals. You know, Salim is a bit of a hedonist.
Obviously.
But he does have that safety net, the one you're referring to at the end, where, like, apropos of nothing, he just stumbles into the kitchen and is basically like, it's getting lame being broke. I think I'm going to take a Wall Street job.
Yeah.
You know, daddy has connections.
Right.
Fuck it, you know?
Yeah.
And yet Barry doesn't even respond because he's just gotten this phone call.
Right.
So, yeah, you have almost this split screen sense where Salim is like, you know, looking in the mirror and like combing his mustache and talking right. about
That's
his
awesome.
Plans.
Yeah.
And Barry's just like distraught in the other room. And of course, goes on to tell almost no one, including his girlfriend, that his father died.
Yeah. I thought that was odd. I guess a criticism of President Obama was his like emotional guard. You know, he has that guard up a lot, like some sort of defense. Mm-hmm. So like to see that happening, but like, God, that ride in the limo going to the wedding was, I was just like, oh my God. Like, I feel like I've been in those situations where girls are like, I don't know where you are right now. And you're
right.
just like, fuck, I don't like, as right. guys, you're like, I don't want to have to ruin your day, ruin the wedding by saying my dad died in a fucking car. My dad did die in a car accident as mm-hmm. well. And like, really? I can understand that, like, feeling like, Jesus Christ, like, what, how do you go on beyond that? You know, like, what kind of feelings do you bring up with that kind of shit?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Another thing the movie really is about is kind of masculinity or masculinities, mm. you know, mm-hmm. and the same way that Barry is kind of trying to figure out who he is. Racially, he's trying to figure out who he is also as a man, and there's sort of competing versions of masculinity, and he's sort of sizing up various potential models throughout the movie, you know, whether it's PJ, whether it's Salim, whether it's like random B-boys on the street or
right,
whatever.
Right.
And yeah, there's that tension between silence and revelation, and yeah, and you know, I think to me it felt very plausible that he would keep something like this to himself. You know, I've also been through sudden tragic deaths, and there's a way in which even speaking it can make it worse, right?
Yeah, you need some time to digest that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the only people he does tell about his father's death in the course of the movie are these Ugandan bartenders at the wedding he attends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now that scene stood out for me, and I think part of it is I was like, what is the message? What was your message for that in that scene? Why in your mind would he choose those two guys to tell this to? What's the message there?
Well, I think there's a few things, and I don't know if there's. I'm resistant to, like, you know, mm-hmm. what is the message?
Because
you know, if a scene is working or a movie's working, there should be multiple things going on. It doesn't, you know, if there was just like a message, I could just write that shit in spray paint on a wall and be done with it.
Put it on a poster in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a number of things are going on, right? I mean, he feels
awesome.
You know, he's isolated at this wedding. It's this, you know, it's his girlfriend's sister's wedding, and he's the only black dude there with the exception of these bartenders.
James.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Boggs, right. Yeah. And James Boggs. Yeah. Yes, good point. But, you know, these guys, I mean, it's safe to talk to them because he'll never see them again. But also, when he hears their voices and realizes that they are from a neighboring country, something resonates in him. He hears them and they remind him of his father, who, of course, he's thinking about already.
Right.
It's kind of an intuitive move. It's not something that he thinks out ahead of time. He goes in there and they pour him a drink, and they can see that something is not quite right with this guy. But also there's this profound separation between them because, you know, he's a guest at this wedding. They keep calling him sir.
All right.
And there's a sense in which he's struggling and grasping for and desirous of a connection to them that he can't necessarily achieve because they're on the other side of the bar and he's wearing a suit and they're wearing bartender uniforms. And so the connection that he does forge by revealing this information to them is both kind of a tender one and a very odd and awkward one. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, there was another scene with them in the movie that unfortunately got cut for sometimes, you know, sometimes cuts happen that are frustrating. And
right.
In this case, it had to do with not the content of the scene, but other factors like how it was shot and
right.
how you transitioned from it and
right.
like the blocking and all that stuff. But there was another very short scene where one of the bartenders approaches him while he's standing outside the tent and asks him what tribe his father was from, and Barry doesn't know offhand, and the guy lists a number of tribes, and Barry's like, that one, you know, the last one you said, and the guy's like, that is my tribe also, you know, like we're brothers or something like that, and it's kind of a final moment, you know. I was attached to it because I wrote the motherfucker. I don't necessarily think the movie suffers from it not being in there.
Yeah.
But I think there's a number of things hopefully going on in that,
right.
scene.
Yeah, yeah. How long did it take you to write the script?
I write very fast.
Yeah.
My approach at this point was with screenwriting in particular is to write a very detailed and elaborate treatment. Which might take me longer than the actual screenplay. So
oh wow, so you write like not just an outline, but a treatment.
A treatment, yeah. Like for a script that ends up being 100 pages, my treatment might be 25 pages. It's scene for scene.
Wow,
it's everything you know that I know about, and it still leaves me room to improvise.
Right,
Vikram and I started developing the story in the summer of 2004, walking around Morningside Heights.
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry. 2014.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 2014, yeah. Not 2004. Yeah.
I was like, damn, right after the Democratic National
Convention. Yeah, right. We saw it coming.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like Vikram actually lived on the block that Barry lived on, 109th between Broadway and Amsterdam, or Amsterdam and Columbus. So we spent the summer talking it through, developing the ideas. I went home to Berkeley that fall and wrote a first draft, I think, in like September of 2014.
Awesome.
And then Vikram and Dana O'Keefe, the creative producer, and I kind of workshopped it and talked it through, and I made revisions, and we, you know, ideas came out. The script changed a lot, but we kept working at it probably for the next 8 months or something, and only when we were really sure that we were completely happy with it did we show it to anyone else.
Right.
We went out for financing with it, and you know, it was really an instructive thing for me. I'd written other scripts, I'd been down the road with other projects that never got made, and after working with Dana and Vikram on the process of developing this, I kind of see why, because our process with this made a lot more sense.
Right.
And we kept it close to the vest until we were sure that it was ready, and when we finally sent it out, it was in a polished enough state that people could really see what it was and what we were trying to do. And of the three companies we sent it to for financing, all of them wanted to finance it, and we were able to pick the one
awesome.
That seemed like the best match and proceed from there. And then it was very fast. I mean, it was a very fast track to production. I mean, I think we sent the script out in, mid-2015. We got fully financed. We shot it in like March and April of 2016.
Wow.
Had a cut ready to premiere at Toronto in September. Netflix bought it there, and it was in theaters and on Netflix by December. So I mean,
Jesus.
It's very rapid in the world. I mean, for the world of film, that's pretty damn quick.
Is this your first screenplay?
First produced screenplay,
first
yeah. I've done some other projects.
Yeah.
I had a screenplay that was at the Sundance Screenwriters Lab a couple years ago. I've written a handful of things, but this is the first one that's been made. Yeah.
So we have people email us when we say like we're going to do this interview. Do you have any questions? We had some people email us some questions. You pretty much answered most of them, but I have one. Did you reference any particular books while making this? And it sounds like you did with Brock's first book. Were there any others?
I mean, in a sense, yes. Not books that I read for like specific research purposes, but books that, in a sense, are part of this sort of nimbus of ideas and stories that are in some way, some perhaps vague way or perhaps pointed way, applicable and part of the story. Invisible Man is certainly one of them.
Right.
Devin read that book to prepare for the role, you know?
Oh, okay.
Devin also did everything to prepare for the role. Like, Devin is Australian.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a great moment when we had just shown the film in Toronto, and, like, everybody was on stage, and we had our ovation and stuff, and then Devin gets the mic, and he's like, you know, he, basically the first thing he says is like, so I'm Australian. And everybody's like, there's like a riot in the building because people are like, no fucking
That's
way.
That's pretty impressive. Was he in L.A.? Did you cast out of L.A.?
No, we cast him out of Perth, Australia.
What?
Yeah.
Did you just have an open casting? Why Perth, Australia?
He was on our radar. So it was really interesting. Devin had been cast by Steve McQueen in a HBO series that McQueen was doing. They shot the pilot and it didn't get picked up.
Steve McQueen. Wow.
So Devin was, it's funny, this is his debut, and we're sort of the beneficiaries of McQueen's worldwide, you know, casting search in which he unearthed Devin.
Oh.
But we got to kind of premiere Devin, debut Devin, which is really cool. I wouldn't say it was an open casting. I know that Vikram saw hundreds of people, and I know that when he saw Devin, he was like, it's a wrap.
Yeah.
But other books, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, things that in one way or another were important would be something like Invisible Man, something like The Dutchman, which is a Baraka play about a relationship between a white woman and a black dude. Another Country for Me by Baldwin was a touchstone in a sense in that. And then, you know, I happen to come in to the project already knowing a lot about New York in 1981 because of, you know, hip hop. Really.
Right.
So I mean there were books and films that were important on that level. You know, something like the documentary Style Wars, which is about graffiti writers, which I've seen, you know, 70 million times. And my daughter has at this point seen enough that she has memorized it and we walk around quoting it to each other.
If I can interject real quick, if you want to see Adam's daughter, you got to check out this Funny or Die video. What was the name of
it? Oh, yeah. My daughter is a rapper. She's 8. She rhymes under the name awesome. The Jazz Wolf. And we recently did a video for a song called Mush Lobster, which, you know, is her tribute to Boston. If you want to see an 8-year-old rapping her ass off in a strong Boston accent about very Boston things while also smashing a lobster with a baseball bat, you should check out Mush Lobster by the Jazz Wolf. Yeah, it was on the Funny or Die homepage, and it's still in their archives there somewhere. So, yeah, you know, a documentary like Style Wars or a movie like Wild Style, you know, these are documents that are from 81, 82, 83, and, you know, capture something about the city at that time. Yeah. I'd say those were important, too. And we cast Fab Five Freddy in almost like a nod to that era, you know, because Fab was he's in Wild Style. And he's also like one of the guys who brought the uptown hip-hop scene downtown to clubs like Danceteria where Barry and Charlotte go to dance. And in a sense, he's a guy who forged connections between black and white uptown and downtown around across racial and class lines. And in a way, that's the same thing that Obama aspires to do politically. So it seemed right and resonant for Fab to play the book vendor in the movie and sort of like as a nod to that time and as a nod to a number of things.
Yeah, that's awesome. So here another question was, you know, historically there's been tension between Harlem and Columbia.
Yeah.
This person's thinking it's getting worse. Do you have any thoughts on that? And it seemed to be part of the Barry. Yeah. There was... Like, he called being called college boy and, you know, that...
Yeah, no, I mean, I think in classic kind of town versus gown, they say... I mean, Columbia is the second largest landowner in Manhattan after Catholic Church. They own a shit ton of property in and around Harlem and just Manhattan in general. Morningside Heights, where the campus is, is surrounded by, you know, sort of Harlem in the north and on the east and... I think that tension is real. It's an oasis of privilege. And in 81, it was an oasis of relative safety in an otherwise pretty gnarly neighborhood. I mean, the block that Barack lived on was still super dicey when I got there in 1994. You could buy coke or weed on that block in 1994. In 81, it was hectic. The fact that he, you know, as the movie opens, he neglects to transfer from... the 2 train to the 1, which is a classic mistake that you make as a Columbia student. You don't realize that the tracks split, and if you don't get off the 2 train, it's going to go east and drop you on 116th, but on the wrong side of Morningside Park. So then you're faced with this dilemma. Do you walk across the park, or do you get back on the downtown train, go back to 96th Street, transfer to the one?
Right, right, right.
So, you know, that crucible of kind of like walking through the park at night.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember doing that. I even have a character do that in a novel that I wrote in 2005. That I think is why Vikram wanted me for this project, because it's about a Columbia student. It's about race. It's called Angry Black White Boy.
Which you can find on Amazon.
Yeah, probably. I don't know if the tension between Columbia and Harlem has gotten worse. I mean, I don't currently live in New York, so I can't definitively say.
Right.
But it would surprise me, because real estate values in Harlem are rising at a staggering pace.
Mm-hmm.
And not to suggest that there's now like equity between Columbia and its sort of neighbors to the north or the east, but all those areas are becoming increasingly kind of gentrified. At least when I go there, it seems that way to me. So I can't honestly say if the tension is getting worse.
But it's been there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the famous student protests at Columbia in 1968 were all around this very issue, around Columbia's plans to build in Harlem and like how that was going to impact the neighborhood, the residents. So students were protesting Columbia's kind of incursions into Harlem. It's for real. Always been a source of tension as far back as I know.
Right, definitely. Right. And were there any like particular traps you fell in when writing this, where you had to be more sensitive to race or more sensitive to class, or like were there moments when you're like, I can't push this much, where just for like storytelling purposes?
I mean, I wanted, you know, I think there's a certain audacity to making a movie about a sitting president where you imagine what he was doing when he was, you know, 21 years old. So, I mean, we didn't want to shy away from any of these things. I wanted to confront those things. If anything, it was more about navigating around anything that might seem too on the nose.
Got it.
For example, one of Barry's ex-girlfriends broke up with him by telling him that what he needed was a strong black woman, that she saw his future wife as like a real strong, powerful, take no shit black woman.
That happened.
Yeah. And you know, there's a longer version of the limousine scene with Charlotte where she says that shit.
Hmm.
And I remember struggling with that and was like, yo, it's funny. Cause like, you know, I used to teach writing, workshops like to graduate students. I was on the faculty for a couple years at Rutgers, and I was teaching like, you know, graduate fiction seminars, and like, this is exactly the kind of thing that my students would come, you know, so you bring a story into workshop and somebody's like, yo, this is too much. This is too on the nose.
Right.
It's too
pushy.
Cut it. And the response might be, but it really happened.
Yeah.
And if I'm the teacher, I'm like, doesn't matter. Not a defense. I don't give a shit what really happened. If it doesn't work on the page, it doesn't work. And this is one of those moments where it's like, oh my God, this really happened. Somebody really said that to him. We have to use that. And then it's like, but at the same time, we can't use that. It's too much.
Right.
And that was one thing that I remember going back and forth on. I mean, I think we even shot the scene with that in it. But ultimately, you know, it was like too much. So there were things like that where it's like, maybe it happened, but maybe it's too much. Maybe it's too on the nose. Vikram, I remember often saying like, I don't want people to be talking about race throughout the movie. And then he and I would battle and go back and forth about that. And I'd be like, but that is what they would be talking about. And, you know, you're in college and this is what happens. And Barry is basically walking around in a world of microaggressions, and it's going to be on his mind. It's going to be on other people's mind and da da da. And like, you know, it was a dynamic push and pull. And, you know, we had to kind of constantly be thinking about how to calibrate it. You know, what do you show? What do you tell? What is too much? But I don't think we ever had a sense that anything was like out of bounds because it was too provocative. It was just like, how do we best serve the story we want to tell was really all.
Well, how do you know if it's too much on the page? Like, what's an indicator of that? Is it just that it reads too true or too false? Or
no, I think it's just
too heavy-handed.
Too heavy-handed would be the
ham-fisted, as they say.
Right, exactly.
Which is a great term.
Yeah, I picture some dude running around with like handfuls of bacon. You know, like what? Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
Is it heavy-handed? Is it too much? I mean, there are some people who will see the movie and think that everything in it is too heavy-handed.
Mm.
There are others who are like, this is the most accurate portrayal of like what it feels like to navigate that world and constantly be, in everybody's crosshairs because right. of who you are and what you look like and what you're supposed to represent.
And other times it all seems like one big distraction. Well, people seem like distractions. I feel like I could just stop talking and, I don't know, just disappear. And become a monk and read and write and think for a year.
Don't do that.
Every time I open my mouth in class, it's like I'm supposed to speak on behalf of all black people. Meanwhile, I quit going to black student union meetings because I didn't feel like I belonged there either.
The world is a big place, honey. You'll find your way.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I love President Obama, and I love like 90% of what he's done in the 8 years that he's been our president. And to watch Barry and to know what happens, it's so incredible that he had many paths he could have chosen, and mm-hmm. to choose one that brought him into community organizing and then running for office. And like you said, he has this like steadfast determination and ambition that it's like he could have easily chosen a different path. Like there could have been a million other ways to have gone.
Yeah,
one of absolutely. Them was like maybe Wall Street or mm-hmm. but the fact that he chose his direction and kept that kind of the stuff that he learned growing up in with a mixed race family and in Indonesia and his friends and makes him so compelling. And what as we close in on the Obama administration, the 8 years, what do you think makes President Obama special? What was from writing this? Like, what do you feel is his, like a special trait that he has?
It's hard to even know where to start. I mean, I think there are so many, but two things that I would say that maybe are less obvious or have been commented on slightly less. I think, number one, he's the best writer of any president that we've seen in a very long time and maybe ever. I mean, this guy is nice with the pen.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
Number two, he's the funniest president that we've ever had.
Very funny.
By leaps and fucking bounds.
Right.
And I've had a number of conversations with people who can testify to that personally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think those two qualities are under
oration.
The radar. No, yeah, I mean, yeah. Clearly. I mean, I think that almost goes without saying that he's a fantastic orator who draws on multiple traditions of oration and melds them in very sophisticated and subtle ways. There are different strains of tradition that he is really conversant with and is kind of recombining the way that he pauses even is incredible. The confidence that it takes to pause and collect your thoughts
right.
without feeling pressed or rushed.
Right. That last speech he gave in Chicago,
yeah.
especially when he's talking about his wife and his kids, and he does that pause where you're absolutely right to not feel that anxious need to fill in dead air, mm-hmm. where he feels confident enough that he can think about it for a second, yeah. is incredible. Did you see the him giving Biden the medal, that speech?
I watched, you know, like the 1 minute clip.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see. I haven't yet watched the speech. That was yesterday.
It was
right?
Yesterday. Yeah. Yeah, pretty incredible stuff. Like he's so emotional. Like when he speaks. Like I usually with presidential speeches, you don't feel anything yeah. other than like okay, whatever. But like that man always makes me think. Always like sometimes I'll just fucking cry because like the stuff like his speech in Chicago was incredible. I love. Great speeches. Jon Favreau is like, have you ever met that dude?
No, never.
Like, he's such a great speechwriter. Mm-hmm. You know, like the way that people can move you with emotion and intelligence and thought. And like, that's for me is like President Obama's one of his great abilities is to bring all that to the fucking page, you know? And I think that's what your script, Barry, illuminates is that he has all of those things going on. He's so well-rounded, you mm-hmm. know, that he can bring all those thoughts to people and constituents, obviously. We're getting near our end, but I haven't even gotten to all my other notes about this. Particularly, like, you worked with Alan Zweibel. Like, what was that all about? So here we go, and...
Alan Zweibel and I met at a book festival in Arizona, I guess maybe 3 years ago now, and he was a fan of Go the Fuck to Sleep, which is a you know, obscene, fake children's book that I wrote a few years ago.
Yes.
And I was, of course, a fan of his because he is one of the original Saturday Night Live writers.
Yes.
And has done a host of other things. It's basically, you know, just a comedy Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
40 years in the business. And we hit it off and we had dinner and we decided that we should try to work together on something. And somehow that something ended up being a children's book series, a middle grades book series about a kid in the present who starts trading letters through time with Benjamin Franklin and eventually travels back in time to try to undo the damage he's done to the future of the country through this correspondence and fucking up the Constitution. Via some jelly that spills from a peanut butter sandwich that he sends back in time. It's pretty ridiculous. And Alan and I worked on those two books together. I wrote the kids' letters because, you know, I'm basically a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
And Alan wrote Franklin's letters because he went to elementary school with Ben Franklin. And it was a lot of fun. And then Alan and Dave Barry and I just wrote a book together.
Oh, wow.
Alan and Dave were friends. They had written a novel together. I grew up reading Dave's columns, and he was like one of my comedy heroes.
Was he out of like St. Petersburg Sentinel? Wasn't he out of like Florida?
Miami Herald?
Miami Herald. Yeah.
And so the three of us just wrote a parody of a Passover Haggadah, the liturgy for the Passover Seder,
nice.
Called "For This We Left Egypt," which will be out in a couple months in time for your 2017 right. or 5777 Seder, depending right, on which calendar you operate on.
The Whitefish is so dry.
Yeah,
he's incredible, man. I mean, like the first Gary Shandling show was one of my all time. When I was a kid watching that shit, I was like, I didn't know TV could do this.
Yeah, no, they broke a ton of boundaries with that. And Alan is the, I think, co-creator of that show.
Yeah.
He and Gary were comedy writing partners for a long time. He's told me some incredible stories and jokes about Gary.
Gary,
you know, what's great about Alan, among other things, is that he's the most kind of faithful straight man you could ask for. He never needs to be the guy making the joke. He's happy to be the butt of the joke.
Right.
He loves to be made fun of.
Yeah.
Like a gig with me, Dave, and Alan is basically Dave and I sitting on either side of Alan on stage and just taking pot shots at him for 2 hours while he laughs his ass off.
I saw him in conversation with Billy Crystal, and it was the same thing.
Oh, yeah, I was at that.
Oh, you were at the Castro?
Yep.
Yeah, Billy just, like, it was all Billy Crystal, and Alan would just be like, yeah.
Right.
And it was hilarious.
Yeah, like, no, Alan is a great guy, and it's been a pleasure to work with him and get to know him. And, you know, not for nothing, he embodies not just the 40 years of comedy history that he was a part of, but another 40 before that.
Right.
So, you know, it's like Alan's reference points are the things he grew up watching. So, you know, his conception of comedy encompasses everything from you know, SNL all the way back to Sid Caesar and Henny Youngman.
Right.
And all of that is very much, and the show of shows, you know, like all of that is very much alive in his sensibility, which is incredible to be around, you know, to learn how he thinks about humor writing has been really fun.
Are you kidding? That must be a treasure.
Yeah.
I mean, he's one of the greatest comedy writers of today.
Yeah.
Like, that guy's a legend. He's
absolutely.
That's amazing. I can't imagine just sitting next to him and chatting, maybe having a scotch or something.
Yeah.
And just like the knowledge he must have about comedy seems incredible.
Yeah.
And I know you wrote Go to the Fuck to Sleep, which was a huge book. I just listened to the Samuel L. Jackson reading this morning of that. Was that for your daughter? Did you write that specifically?
Yeah. My daughter, the Jazz Wolf, was like 2 and a half when I wrote that book, and sleeping was not high on her list of priorities. and it's funny. It's a book I wrote with very few expectations.
Yeah.
Never really even imagined that I would publish it, which is funny because I don't generally ever write anything without that intention. But at the time, there was no such genre as obscene fake children's books.
Right.
That book, I think, pretty much invented it. So, you know, sometimes you hit a bullseye that you didn't even know existed.
Yeah.
And that book was really just an attempt to honestly render the interior monologue of a parent, you know, faced with this task of trying to put a child to bed.
Right.
And I didn't really necessarily think that it had any universal appeal. I thought maybe it was just true for me. But it turns out that it was kind of a taboo that needed breaking, you know, that like there's a fence around what you're allowed to talk about as a parent. There's a certain preciousness, you know, and it's kind of the opposite of honesty, but people nurture these private frustrations that can really overwhelm you. And this book, I think, gave them a certain kind of catharsis and gave them permission to talk about some of these difficult things. And I think that's why it kind of resonated and found its audience.
Yeah. Absolutely. It seems like it found its audience far and wide. It's been translated 40 times or something?
Yeah, we're in about 40 languages. You know, it's funny. There's like three different Spanish translations. There's the Spanish, the Mexican, the Latin American translations. My favorite fact is that it's been translated into Jamaican patois. Only two books have ever been translated from standard English into patois.
Awesome.
The Bible is one of them. Go the Fuck to Sleep is the other.
Yeah.
But only one of those two has an audiobook by Shaggy. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Adam, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate this. Congrats
on
the show and whatever else you got coming up. Now I want to do a little dipping into that record collection.
Yeah. You know, let's do it.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe, review, and rate.
For show notes and more information about George and Paco's appearances, visit supdocpodcast.com. You can send your corrections, questions, or comments to supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
We'd also like to thank Documentary News for their continued support. Please check out documentarynews.com.
Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @supdocpodcast.
This show is produced by Will Scovel and our theme music by David Siegel.